You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 4th of May 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's program, we'll be kicking off the show by discussing two new books about common garden creatures, which turn out to be much more interesting than you suspect, bees and snails.
Then we'll be crossing to the US. It's Kentucky Derby Day, so today's music review will have a suitably southern tinge as we explore the music inspired by the big race.
And we'll also be exploring icons in architecture and on film over in Los Angeles.
Here's Johnny!
And we'll be hearing some tips from Monocle's transport editor, Tristan McAllister, that wasn't him, on how to spend the perfect weekend in New York.
So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
And hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House. You're listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias. We have bunches of stuff ahead of us, as we just outlined there. But first of all, Gillian, have you been doing anything cultural this week?
Well, I have indeed. I'm still a little jet-lagged from the trip that I took with Rob Bound to LA, and we had an amazing trip because we went there to do a film on Paris Photo LA, which is this incredible photography market and festival that's been for 17 years in Paris, and this is the first year they decided to transport it to Los Angeles inside the studios of Paramount Pictures, partly to kind of take advantage of the great market for photography there, but also to explore the blurring lines between the still image and the moving image. And where better? Hollywood.
Is there still a great market for the still image, though, or do the people there think there still is? Because it is photographers are among those people who complain loudest and longest about what modern media has done to their trade.
I think the people in, well, California, but LA in particular, they love their photography and they love collecting photographers. And, you know, maybe more in these modernist houses in LA and houses on the beach, they actually, you know, photographs are the art on their walls. So they are, it is a very, very healthy market for buying photography as art, but also publishers commissioning photographers. So there was definitely a lot of wheeling and dealing. I mean, you know, people making deals on cell phones. You'd think you were in the kind of movie making business.
Okay, well, we shall have more on yours and Rob's adventures in Hollywood towards the end of the program. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. First of all, we will be talking about books, and urban dwellers who are fortunate enough to own gardens tend to have complicated relationships with the creatures which dwell in them. Some, generally such picturesque, productive or otherwise agreeable squatters as frogs, bumblebees and wild birds, we try to encourage. Others, including such unregenerate marauders as squirrels, slugs and feral pigeons, we tend to find ourselves, or maybe this is just me, swearing at quite a lot.
In this week's book review, we're looking at two books which consider a couple of these creatures. One, Ruth Brooks' A Slow Passion, makes the case for the snail. It's a book that might make you think twice before dumping another handful of them over the fence, like me. The other, Dave Golson's A Sting in the Tail, recounts one man's efforts to reintroduce one of Britain's vanished bumblebee species. So joining us now to discuss them is writer, journalist and regular review bookworm Mark Mason. Hello.
Hi there.
So, I mean, this is the perfect season as Britain in Bloom comes to the fore to discuss literature about bees and snails. How did you come across these two books?
I came across them because I was reviewing them, both for a magazine, and they came sort of roughly the same, you know, within a couple of months of each other. And they struck me, they were very similar in that they're written by non-scientists. Well, I mean, Dave Golson, the bee guy, is an acknowledged bee expert now. But he starts off by saying how he started getting interested in them as a kid. Very similar to Ruth Brooks, who's the snail author. And she's a complete amateur, although she's gone on to enter amateur science competitions. Because like you, she has problems with her snails. And she tried everything to get rid of them. Coffee grounds, apparently she heard, were the...
It's impossible.
Absolute anathema to snails. Snails will just get a mile away very quickly.
Well, no, they won't do it very quickly either. They'll do it really very slowly.
Do you know what? One of the details in her book, and I've just worked out an exclusive Monocle statistic here. We can wow the world with this. This has never been worked out before.
Drumroll.
That she finds out that the world snail speed record is held by Archie. at 0.05 miles an hour, which I have just worked out for you is exactly 1/540th of Usain Bolt's top speed.
That may be the least impressive world record ever set. It is the contrast between the two books is interesting, and they're both lovely and passionate books. But I mentioned in the setup there that you tend to end up dividing the creatures in your garden, the ones you want and the ones you don't.
Yeah.
Snails tend to get a fairly bad press, whereas everybody loves bumblebees. I suppose the one thing we could call, I mean, the really interesting one, if someone's actually to write a book trying to make a case for wasps, that would be an interesting heresy, because everybody hates wasps, which are basically the football hooligans of the insect world. But we'll start with the snails. But what does Ruth Brooks like about snails, and what does she discover about them?
Well, what's great about the book is that she started off, as you say, hating them. Like everyone, they just eat through all her delphiniums, and she tries everything to get rid of them. But she realises in the end that they are lovable creatures, and what really gets her attention is that, I mean, she still wants to keep them away from her flowers, but she realises that they've got incredible abilities. They home like pigeons. Everyone knows that
this was news. Home. This was news to me. The but homing
explain
snail.
This.
She
explain
notices
how...
that they keep coming back to the same place from no matter how far away she takes them. And she takes them hundreds of yards from house, across major roads, across through forests that there's
and
no way they can get through.
The shells with different colour nail varnish so she can
varnish.
Tell they're her snails.
This is how she ends up. On BBC Radio, they run an amateur scientist competition. And she ends up entering that and wins it because of these efforts she's made to paint nail varnish on the shells.
You would need to be an extraordinarily patient researcher, wouldn't you? This is not one of those experiments that's going to reap instant benefit.
It isn't, but it's also
it's like I'm going to take a snail 200 yards over there and now I wait.
And they don't know how bees do it. They're still mystified. The bee guy will tell you that they don't know how bees will home the equivalent of 4 trips to the moon in human terms, and they don't know how they do it. They do a waggle dance. They know about the waggle dance. Which is where they, as the bee is flying back to the hive from a brilliant source of flowers, a brilliant source of pollen, hundreds of yards away, miles away, when it meets someone from its own hive who's on its way out, it will do a little dance and it will waggle its bottom in the direction of the flowers. And the number of times it waggles its bottom equates to how far away those flowers are. They're incredible creatures.
I think what I find interesting is both these books kind of celebrate our kind of longing for the slow life. Everything's so fast. And I just find, you know, when my head is so full of noise, I sit out in my little kind of terrace garden with my coffee or my glass of wine. And I do watch the snails slowly move. And there's this sort of intrigue and fascination into these creatures.
But and then you look into them. That's how Ruth Brooks started, exactly the same, as a gardener. Mm-hmm. And she gets into them and then finds out incredible things about them. Like they're hermaphrodites. I didn't know that. Snails are, and the mating, well, I won't go into the details now because it'd take too long and slightly indelicate, but just snails mating is just unbelievable. And they're deaf. Snails are deaf. And in South Korea, their mucus
that's
is...
That's why they don't move when I shout at them.
Hey! Now it's making sense.
Now
and
making
in South
sense.
Korea, they use snail mucus to make face cream.
Maybe that's what I should do with my snails in my garden.
I think there is a process for us. Don't just pick the snail up and rub it. But she also finds out that mucus is absolutely incredible in terms of, she puts an absolute razor-sharp knife down to try and discourage them. And the snail can go up one side of the knife, over the very, very razor-sharp edge with its mucus protecting it, and then down the other side. Unbelievable creatures.
Dave Goulson's book about bees, the inevitably but excruciatingly titled A Sting in the Tail, T-A-L-E, you see what he's done.
Oh, come
there.
On, he got our attention, Andrew, it's yeah, worked.
Indeed, but he does have a serious point to make, which is that bee populations worldwide are under threat, which is potentially incredibly dangerous.
But it's massively in the news at the moment in Europe because the EC are trying to bring in, and I think they have now said they're going to have a 2-year experiment because of certain neonicotinoids or a certain sort of pesticide that are very harmful. But he points out that if humans were to disappear, the ecosystem would quickly revert to a perfectly balanced, stable state it was in about 10,000 years ago. If insects disappeared and if bees disappear with what they do with pollination, the whole thing would just fall apart. It would absolutely be the end of, literally would be the end of the earth as we know it. So they are far more important than us.
So, I mean, fascinating in a point of science, but what about the writing of these books? Are they a good read?
They are, because, like I say, what really charmed me about both of them is it's sort of the amateur. You're coming at it as a non-expert. Lots of science books tell you, right, there's this, 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 and this, and it's like a university lecture. Whereas these, they tell you, in both cases, why they got interested in the subject and what, as an amateur, got them hooked. And in Dave's case, the bee guy, it was when he was a kid, and he turns out to be, I think we need more conservationists like him cack-handed animal killers. Because when he's a kid, that's how he gets... He tries to save these things. He tries to... The first lot of bees he tries to save, he notices they've got absolutely sodden in a downpour, in a rainstorm. And so he puts them on a tray and puts them in the electric cooker to try and dry them out.
What could go wrong?
Then goes off to feed some of his other pets, and it's only the smell of burning that reminds him that the bees are in the cooker. He comes back and he's absolutely killed them. It's not just bees that he picks on, by the way. He tries amateur taxidermy with his mother's wire coat hangers, and he gets a gull that's died. And tries to put these wire coat hangers in it to tax it, you know, to stuff its body and keep it preserved, and gets everything at completely the wrong angle. It's got one wing sticking up and its leg is broken.
At the risk of taking a slightly mercenary view of these books, but how do you think they're likely to do? Because I just asked because, you know, in my own dealings with people working in publishing these days, if you mention anything about narrative nonfiction anymore written by somebody who, you know, isn't a terrible comedian who's on television all the time, they tend to just sort of mime slinging a rope over a light fitting. It is pretty gruesome out there.
As someone who writes his own books and has been trying to work out what's going to be the next big hit for a dozen years now, if publishers knew anything, why did 11 of the 12 of them turn down the first Harry Potter? No one, as Ray Charles said in another field, they said, don't do a country and western album, Ray. No, you're making a fortune with your rhythm and blues. He said, ain't no son of a bitch nowhere knows what's going to hit. No one knows what's going to be the next big hit.
No, that is very true. But do you think that there might be something in this, though? The sort of the... Because there is something about the British and gardens. I mean, I grew up in Australia where we do have gardens, but we have a slightly different relationship with them, in that ours are just full of things which can just leap up and kill you.
Literally.
At a second's notice.
Yeah.
Spiders.
You tend to be a little more circumspect in your dealings with the outdoors where I come from. But do you think there's something about these books that would appeal to that contemplative British relationship with the garden?
Absolutely. As we've been saying here, our own experiences of gardening are what interest us about the snails, and that's how it starts. So yeah, and absolutely chimes with the reader's experience, which is always a big reason that anything's going to be a hit in the first place. Yeah, absolutely.
And what kind of background did these two, did they have any background? You talk about them as enthusiastic amateurs in being sort of scientists and conservationists. Are they enthusiastic amateurs where the writing is concerned, or do they have pedigree and background on that front?
No. They're both very well-written books. I mean, they're a joy to read because they're simple. They obey the first rule, which is keep it simple. They don't try and be flashy with the writing.
I love each one, whether it's the snail book or the bee book. Every chapter opens up with a quote, and it could be a quote with a humorist or a scientist, like, of course, Albert Einstein here, talking really a bit about what you were saying. If honeybees became extinct, human society would follow for years, follow on in years. Or, again, by humorist, a bee is never as busy as it seems. It's just it can't buzz any slower. But there's some lovely quotes.
I think they'd be great for getting kids interested in science because they've got those lovely little facts like... I was talking about this with someone this morning, talking about coming here to do this, and one of the stats in the bee book is that they flap their wings 200 times a second. Can you just try and imagine that? Can you? It's just impossible.
Yeah. I don't know. I tend to get a bit sceptical of statistics like that. Who's counting?
People with very, very clever cameras that can slow it down, Andrew, so don't be a cynic.
There's a lovely sort of, awareness of their own ultimate absurdity in both of these books as well. There's a great self-knowing humour about it. There's a lovely line in the start of one chapter of Ruth Brooks' A Slow Passion, where she talks about how she hoped to lull the snails into a sense of false security, tempting them to relax. I like this idea that there's an opposite to this, that there's an agitated snail.
What does a stressed snail look like?
For the love of God, don't wind the snails up. Everything will be ruined. They'll go nuts.
And of course, the opposite is what does an unstressed bee look like? Can you imagine an unstressed bee? They're always buzzing around. But except apparently, there's a beekeeper in London who, in Brixton, where there is, you know, a certain amount of what used to be called jazz woodbines smoked for once in a while, apparently bees marijuana has the opposite effect on bees that it has on humans.
They
get
really
very, very angry. If you think you've seen a bee angry, give one a joint and then see what happens. They just go mental.
We must stress that Monocle 24 does not recommend, as an institution, giving marijuana to bees. Mark Mason, thank you as ever for joining us on today's review. A Sting in the Tail by Dave Gulson is published by Jonathan Cape, and Ruth Brooks' book, A Slow Passion, Snails, My Garden and Me, is published by Bloomsbury. Do stay with us on the review. Up next, we'll be hearing about exhibitions in Hong Kong, Rio and Berlin.
Come with us from
Georgia
before we zip to
Istanbul
on Route 4 as we meet the people who are charting, finessing, celebrating and refreshing our metropolises.
You have to design a street for the speed at which a human being walks rather than for the automobile.
If you're trying to look at this place as an organ, it doesn't get enough blood. So it's on the verge of a heart attack, I'd say.
What's always attracted me about the square is that it is a London organism. It's something that's peculiar to this city.
The Urbanist is Monocle 24's show about the cities we live in that delivers insights into city halls, the views from the tops of towers, the stories of hidden rivers, and discovers why we still love that brutalist old beast, concrete.
Everything we use, touch, and our entire economy is based upon nature. The only difference now is that we tend to be less able to see that because we're living in a world of concrete, glass, and steel.
The Urbanist, presented by me, Andrew Tuck, premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time.
How far is the park? Does the park have a place where they can sit? Does the park have shade for them?
Join your fellow city lovers and leave the countryside to the people who prefer barns to bars and quiet walks to sidewalks.
If you're looking for great Monocle content on your smartphone or tablet device, download the Monocle app today. We'll bring you the daily Monocolumn Bulletin with fresh opinions from our editors, the essential 2525 City Guide to the best business cities and resorts, and the full Monocle 24 radio experience with our time shift player, so you can catch up on any shows you may have missed. Download our Monocle app today for your smartphone or tablet. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias and Andrew Muller. Now, time to cross to Associate Editor Nelly Gocheva for our weekly roundup of cultural treats from around the world this weekend.
Artist Shilay's solo exhibition opens this weekend in the spacious Feast Projects Gallery, located on the harbour of Hong Kong's Ap Lei Chau district. The vivid, vibrantly coloured oil paintings are on display until the 7th of June. This Saturday, London's moviegoers have the opportunity to sample a slice of Latvian cinema. Housed in Rich Mix Cinema in Bethnal Green, the event will air three documentary features by Hertz Frank, Juris Podnieks, and Juris Poskas. If in Rio this weekend, stop by Instituto Moreira to check out the exhibition Lugar Nenhum, or in English, Nowhere Place. It features 56 works from Brazilian painters Marina Reigans, Ana Prata and Rodrigo Andrade, as well as photography by Luisa Balden, Rubens Mano and Sofia Borch, to name a few. Lugar Nenhum is on until the 2nd of June. This weekend in Berlin, head to Gallery Maid to see Five Cuts, a visual dialogue with Yoji Yamamoto. The cuts are video installations exploring five topics taken from conversations conducted in Tokyo and Paris, especially for Maid. The footage reveals Yamamoto's vision on love, life and art. For more details, go to maid-blog.com. And finally this weekend, we'll be listening to the new album The Ways We Separate from Brooklyn duo Beacon. The band combines pop melodies with subtle electronic beats. Let's hear Bring You Back. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
was Bring You Back by Beacon, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva.
And it's time now on the review for our weekly music review. It's the first Saturday in May, otherwise known to American turf aficionados since 1875 as Kentucky Derby Day. The Kentucky Derby is one of those horse races, like the Melbourne Cup or the Grand National, which is far more than a horse race. It's a high point of the Southern cultural calendar, attracting socialites, revelers, racing fans and tipsters.
Such is the Derby's legendary stature that it has been celebrated in song by many musicians. So joining us today to discuss their efforts for our weekly music review is Rachel Graham, director of Passé, who works as a music talent and project manager in London. Hello, Rachel.
Hi.
So first up, are you from Kentucky? What is your expertise in this field?
I am from Kentucky. I'm a sort of blend of American and Scottish. My father's from the Isle of Lewis and my mother is from Louisville, Kentucky. So that is my interest in Kentucky. I was born there and I moved to the UK when I was 19.
And how big a deal is Derby Day in Louisville?
It's pretty massive. I mean, if you consider the sort of national pride that comes along with like a huge football team and, you know, getting into the European Cup in any given city and all of the nationalistic pride that goes around that. It's kind of the same sort of vibe, but people are just really stoked on living in Louisville and being there for the Derby. And
it's a whole social scene, isn't it? It's like old money and old stories.
Yeah, it's. I was thinking about it today. It's actually quite apt with all of the press around The Great Gatsby coming back out because the character in The Great Gatsby, Daisy, was actually from Louisville, written in the book. So it's a lot of this kind of old money you know, socialite scene. There's a big party that's thrown by these twins that were like called the Doublemint Twins that were in a Doublemint chewing gum commercial like way back in the day. Not that far back, but a little bit. They probably wouldn't like that too much.
Is this one of those sporting events where the actual sporting event kind of gets forgotten about by everybody?
Well, it's easy to be forgotten about because it's actually only 2 minutes long. But I think that there is a huge focus on that 2 minutes. But there is heaps of so much fanfare that actually, I think that it can get shoved under the carpet a little bit.
And talking of fanfare, the opening music is key to the whole event. I mean, it's become quite legendary in its own right with sing along versions. I gather.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think that everybody sort of knows the words to My Old Kentucky Home in the same way that people know the beginning of the Gettysburg Address, or they kind of know like the Pledge Allegiance or something like that. But it's a huge traditional part of the whole ceremony.
My Old Kentucky Home is the first of the Kentucky Derby related songs that you have selected for us. It was written by Stephen Foster, who's possibly at least as well known for having written Oh Susanna, Camptown Races, the sort of great American folk songwriter. And I think everybody pretty much has covered My Old Kentucky Home at various points. Randy Newman, Louis Armstrong, Ry Cooder, Bing Crosby, Paul Robeson, and everybody else imaginable, pretty much. It goes a bit like this. That was My Old Kentucky Home, as played at last year's Kentucky Derby by the University of Louisville's marching band. That's the song that the horses appear to.
Yeah, when they come out onto the field, they all walk out to My Old Kentucky Home, which I didn't realize that every year is played by the University of Louisville marching band, and that they record it every year, and then they allow people to listen.
Sort of heartily sung along with, or is it like the Star Spangled Banner? Is it American sporting events, or is it a bit more like, having grown up in Australia, I remember when they play the Australian national anthem at Australian sporting events, everyone sings the first line, which is the only one everybody knows, then there's a lot of communal mumbling and it finally gets drowned out by everyone yelling get on with it.
No, people don't generally sing along. It's kind of a moment of respect to the horses and respect to the race, I think. But no, I have never seen anyone sing along at the Derby. I've seen on TV, though, where people have kind of stood with their hand over their heart in the way that it's like they've forgotten that it's not actually the Pledge of Allegiance. But those people, taking a step too far.
It's pretty much the state anthem of Kentucky, though, surely. I don't know. Do you take your hat off for a state song? I'm not sure what the protocol is.
I'm not sure either. I mean, I definitely would say that it is the most well-known anthem for Kentucky, but I wouldn't know if it was the state song per se.
Okay. What about Kentucky music more in general? Like, what's the heritage? What's the background of the music there?
Well, the traditional music from the area is bluegrass. And there's a lot of different types of bluegrass, and it's not absolutely my forte, but I do absolutely love it. It's just there's something about the sound of it and the spirit of the tracks when you hear them that is really quite moving, and they all tell stories, and I'm a sucker for a good story. And so, yeah, it's just about kind of passing along these stories. And there's a bluegrass festival in Louisville every year that I remember my dad taking me to pretty much every year. And we would just kind of go and watch these guys. But because my father's from Scotland, a lot of the typical instrumentation for bluegrass music is very similar to Scottish folk music. So it was very much a nostalgia thing for him, seeing like people playing the fiddle and things like that.
Well, on that subject, there's another Kentucky-related standard, which is arguably the bluegrass standard written by, well, the bluegrass pioneer Bill Monroe. This is three versions of Blue Moon of Kentucky.
Blue moon of Kentucky, keep on shining. Shine on the one it's gone. On shining, shine on the one that's gone and left me blue.
Blue moon, blue moon, blue moon, keep shining bright. Blue moon, keep on shining bright. You're gonna bring me back on my baby tonight. Blue moon, keep shining bright.
I said, blue moon of Kentucky, keep on shining. Shine on the one that's gone and left me blue. Blue moon of Kentucky, keep on shining. Shine on the one that's gone and left me blue.
Three compressed versions of Blue Moon of Kentucky, originally written by Bill Monroe. We heard a very straightforward bluegrass version, Elvis Presley's version, which was one side of his first ever single in 1954, and after that, Patsy Cline's, the second choice of our musical guest today. Rachel, what's your third one we've picked up on?
Pardon?
The third sampling you've picked up on. This is a Moonshiner.
Oh, right. So when I first started really exploring bluegrass again in my adult life, I happened upon this amazing bluegrass anthology. And, of course, it's like, you know, six CDs of all of this amazing scratchy bluegrass music varying in quality of recordings. But I was just listening through one of the CDs one day, and I heard this song, and I thought, I know this song. Like, how would I know this song? And it turns out I had heard it, first of all, on a Cat Power record. And she had done this amazing kind of very quintessentially Cat Power rendition in her own way of this track, Moonshiner, which is about a guy who's talking about, you know, moonshining, making his own alcohol. And so when I listened to it again, this original version with this kind of new ears, it was so strange to hear it in a kind of reverse history, you know, hearing the cover first and being very familiar with that and then going back to hear the original version.
What was your relationship like with bluegrass growing up? Because it is Kentucky's music. It's what Kentucky is famous for. And I think there's a real tendency, and I've spoken to so many people about this, especially Americans who grow up in an area identified with one particular sort of music. They go through this phase in their childhood adolescence of just wanting to listen to anything else and just being absolutely embarrassed and appalled by the music of where they come from, but eventually they find themselves going around in a big loop and coming back to it and going, actually, this isn't so bad. Yeah. Has it been like that for you with bluegrass?
It actually hasn't, because when I was growing up and I would go to these bluegrass festivals, the types of people that would go were just completely across the board. So it's not like these kind of, you know, big country boys and, you know, that kind of vibe. It was literally a cross-section of kind of everyone that you would expect to see walking around, you know, in a park or in a mall or whatever. So it didn't feel essentially uncool growing up. But then moving on from that, I guess the reason why it never really seemed uncool was because there were so many people championing that type of music locally. So Will Oldham, who also puts out music as Palace and in the past and Bonnie Prince Billy now, he, you know, writes and re-sings a lot of old folk songs. So being into his music growing up, there's a lot of kind of throwback to this bluegrass kind of country strand in new music.
Okay, well, we're going to play a sort of mashed up version of two versions of Moonshiner as well. This is another song which has been done by pretty much everybody, including, I think, Elliott Smith and Uncle Tupelo are two versions that leap immediately to mind. This is a traditional version and the Cat Power version that you mentioned. Power's version of the bluegrass standard Moonshiner, the third selection of today's musical guest, Rachel Graham, director of Passé. And on that subject, we should talk a bit about what Passé does and what Passé is doing.
Well, basically, I have been working in and around music in the UK since 2002. I went to the Glasgow School of Art and studied fine art photography, and then subsequently ran the Art School Student Union, which hosted heaps of bands that came through Glasgow, Franz Ferdinand, Sons and Daughters, Errors, and just, you know, the Scissor Sisters' first ever UK show. But and then moving on from that, I started working with two DJs and producers from Glasgow called Optimo, and we did a whole slew of really amazing events and parties together for about 5 years. And then I moved to London and still keep working on different kind of music projects, less events and more kind of talent sourcing for brand-related projects or talent management. I manage a band called KXP from Helsinki, who I believe was on the review
yes, they
a
were.
While ago. And And also a French DJ who now lives in London called Yvan Smag from Kill the DJ Records in Paris.
Well, for now, thank you very much for joining us. That was Rachel Graham, director of Passé, this week's guest music reviewer on the Kentucky Derby Day edition of The Review. You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
Staying in the US now, we're crossing over to New York. For today's City Review, our transport editor Tristan McAllister has given us his take on how to spend your weekend in the Big Apple.
If you were to ask me the best way to pass a day in New York City this weekend, I'd tell you about a few things. The first is a free ferry ride on the East River and a trip to one of New York's best neighborhoods, Red Hook. Simply go to the South Street Seaport and look for the yellow water taxis that ply the waters. You want the IKEA ferry, which runs every 20 minutes or so. Hop on free of charge and you'll be off to Red Hook in no time. But if synthetic veneers and meatballs aren't your thing, there's plenty else to see on nearby Van Brunt Street.
Well, show me the way to the next whiskey bar.
Pop into Dry Dock Wine and Spirits for rare whiskeys, or stroll out the pier and enjoy the river view and the Statue of Liberty in the distance. It's a great way to spend a lazy summer Sunday afternoon with a picnic. Staying in Brooklyn, I'd also pop up to the Brooklyn Navy Yard for a tour and history lesson on how the incredible ships built there were key in keeping the U.S. Navy vital during a few wars. There's an exhibit called Building 92. It recaps the building's rich history from the Revolutionary War to present. Admittedly, a Navy Yard and war history might be a bit much. A little less heady might be a celebration of Bike Month. Plenty to do on two wheels in New York, so if you're looking to cut yourself loose from the subway and enjoy the city on velo, maybe you should head for Tribeca on Sunday. There you'll find the start of the TD 5 Borough Bike Tour, but bring your saddle grease. It's a 40-mile tour with 32,000 riders across five bridges. That might be enough for this weekend, but next weekend, you should surely head to Randall's Island and the Frieze Art Fair. This is the second year the well-known London Affair has set up an outpost in New York. Buses will even take you from the Guggenheim Museum straight to the tents along the river. Or simply go by boat at the 34th Street dock at the FDR Expressway. Whatever you do, enjoy. For Monocle in New York, I'm Tristan McAllister.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be continuing our American theme next, but facing the Pacific.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
Well, I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban when I was 26 years old, and I sort of just saved my money and went to photograph women living under the Taliban. And now I realize, wow, that was pretty dangerous.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week shows for an hour of essential listening.
A fair at the end is on the one side a market platform, but I think especially here in Asia and in Southeast Asia, it should also be a place of an exchange, of a get-together.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24, brought to you in association with Rolex.
If you're looking for a present for a loved one, something for the home, or some luggage to take on the road, why not visit one of our shops? Our beautifully appointed shops in London, New York, Toronto, Hong Kong, and Tokyo sell a selection of the fruits of our collaborations with a number of our favorite brands, including Porter, Hackett, Ettinger, Barena, and many others too. Plus, we can also help out filling in any gaps in your collection of back issues. So why not visit any of our shops today? You're guaranteed a very warm welcome.
And Welcome back to the studio. It's Saturday. You're listening to The Review with me, Gillian DeBias, and Andrew Muller.
Now, for those living on the east and west coasts of the United States, there's long been a rivalry between the big cities, with New York boasting of its art and underground scene, and Los Angeles its star-making power and movie-making heritage.
But with the launch of Pacific Standard Time, the massive 2011 arts initiative, LA has upped its ante as a world-class museum capital. These days, the city is a vibrant contemporary art scene that embraces its iconic urban landscape and its celluloid magic dust.
And to talk us through two exhibitions currently showing in Los Angeles that reflect exactly this, we are joined in the studio today by our very own culture and pop culture expert, it says here. Robert Bound, welcome.
That means I should say something like morning cats, right?
Well, welcome to The Review. How are you?
I'm right. I'm hanging there. It's fine.
Excellent. These two exhibitions, which one would you like to start with?
Why don't we start with the Kubrick at LACMA. This is a kind of huge career spanning, sort of exhaustive. It's kind of it's as if the man together put the show together almost. Yeah. The man himself put the show together.
Well, being John Malkovich is like being Stanley Kubrick inside his head.
Yeah, it was. It's a sort of show full of index cards, posters, lenses. Gillian, we went and visited the show
together
this time last week. And it's a show that you can, if you're like Gillian and you're a proper trained producer and camerawoman, you can nerd out over all the sort of lenses that he had specially made for films like Barry Lyndon, where he only shot using natural light and candlelight and all the rest of it, as much as all the different posters from all the different sort of parts of the world. So you get sort of creepy Polish posters, and you get very kind of bombastic American action posters.
It was very fun going with Rob, because we get our tickets, we get in, we're both very excited. We walk through the doors, past the dark sort of screens, and then I beeline for the center cabinet with all the lenses and the cameras, and Rob beelines to the scripts and all the script notes. You can tell what we both do at Monocle.
Yeah, it's an amazing show. I mean, it's sort of, as I say, it's kind of exhaustive. And it does kind of it seems to sort of drill down into the nub of Kubrick's kind of peculiar genius and obsessions. Like looking at his script, looking at his notes on scripts, for example, is sort of fascinating. I mean, you've never seen a piece of paper with less print on it and more pencil, for example.
We do, on the subject of his peculiar genius and obsessions, we do have a sort of Stanley Kubrick showreel, which I think now would be
on radio.
I wonder if at the end of this, we're going to give him the job.
We'll decide.
You know how we've always talked about the possibility of something going wrong with the bomb.
What exactly is the treatment going to be then?
Just need to show you some film.
You little scumbag! I got your name! I got your ass! You will not laugh! You will not cry!
Stop it! Stop it, please! I beg you!
Well, what made you call?
The whole point of the Doomsday Machine is lost.
If you keep it a secret,
why didn't you tell the world, eh?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
Highlights from the eventful career of Stanley Kubrick, subject of a major new exhibition at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. You were talking there, Rob, about the scripts and the annotated notepad. Stanley Kubrick was always quite keen, I think, to project this image of himself as this slightly unhinged, obsessive, micromanaging control freak. Yeah. Is this exhibition basically where we discover, yep, entirely true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. One of those things where he kind of certainly achieved to set out the legend that he wanted to become, and he became it fairly soon on. We were talking about this, right?
Yeah,
that he does there's obviously a lot of photographs of him on set and with his his actors and doing making the movies. And it does seem to be a sort of progression from being a fairly handsome younger guy into kind of...
to an eccentric, mad...
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Reclusive filmmaker.
That's what happens when you come in on Saturday mornings. It's happening to me.
It reminds you of what a lot of people said about the David Bowie exhibition at the V&A, that you learn something in the sort of the arcana and detritus there of the sort of incredible single-mindedness that's actually required to become a sort of great self-invented artist.
Yeah, it is that thing. And you exactly, like Bowie, I think there is that idea of being having a phenomenal raw talent, but all the 99% of crazy sweat that you never see beneath, well, for Bowie, beneath the makeup, and beneath the haircuts, and beneath the clothes, you know? And there is an idea of, yeah, the projection of this thing. And of course, you know, Kubrick was never on screen. He wasn't, he never even made any cameos.
It is always kind of depressing to discover that these sort of ineffable, untethered geniuses actually beneath all that have just worked like dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's rather a shame. It's rather a shame, but then I think, well, at least I do too. but we heard in that minute of Kubrick's sort of greatest hit stuff, we heard obviously a huge amount of music. And there's a lot of it. There's a great room devoted to Kubrick's use of music, his use of song, and that's a kind of great thing. They sort of take films to bits and focus on little small bits of them to make larger points. And the music room's very affecting, isn't it, Jane?
Well, it was very affecting. It was also a bit like pop-up videos because you have this dark room, people sitting on the floor and on benches, and the film clips and the music. And then on the side, there are little annotated notes that come up and explain the track of music that was used, why it was used, and little anecdotes behind it. And you could have stayed in there for hours just watching and listening to it all. That was my problem with the museum. I could have spent the whole day there. I was stuck in the first two rooms by the time you were out of there.
Gillian was essentially doing the equivalent of writing, typing over and over again, all work and no play. Makes Gillian a dull girl. There was a great, one of my favourite rooms was the room devoted to Clockwork Orange and the Moloko milk bar. And there were the girls, you know, the statues that dispensed the milk from their tits, you know. And they had these kind of like super kind of hyper erotic, almost like sort of Japanese manga style statues of these girls. And I overheard a guy, I think they must have been on a, it must have been a first date, a guy and a girl walking around this show when we were there. And he kind of, and I don't know how you could have
It's a real make or break first date location, isn't it?
I hate Kubrick.
This could go one of two ways.
Exactly. Regarding these kind of like sort of hyper porno kind of sculptures. And he was kind of like going, I remember when I first saw this, I thought it was kind of weird. And I was like, man, I wish he'd curated this show. Imagine the insights we would have got if this man had written all the notes, written the book, and put this thing together. That would have been great.
The exhibition also includes, I believe, a section dedicated to Stanley Kubrick projects that were never completed. Were they not completed because he died or didn't have enough money, or even by his standards, they were so completely bonkers that nobody else would touch them?
Timing. There was a couple. Famously, he put sort of 5 years of research and Kubrick research, which is drilling down into the crazy minutiae of every detail of Napoleon's life. And this was the great, Kubrick's sort of great unfinished sort of masterpiece. And there's a room devoted to that and all the sets that he was wanting to design.
What was it you think Kubrick saw in the diminutive power craze? obsessive look conqueror of all these
things. All we needed really was a picture of that Kubrick had commissioned of himself on a huge horse, him looking strong on a horse with maybe the wind in his hair. But this was a film that was cut by the studio because someone else had made a film about Napoleon and it was a flop. And you know, you have this thing, it happens in Hollywood right now as well. It always seems to have this cyclical thing where people make films about the same person and one's a hit and one's a miss. Maybe one's better than the other and they're not necessarily justified by their box office takings. But that was the thing.
But I was reading one article and they were describing the exhibition as kind of, it's a huge space, like little microclimates. And it was in fact true because every single room is a different film, but they create a different atmosphere around that film. And Rob was talking about his favorite room. Mine was the Barry Lyndon one, which is all about cinematography, just with daylight and candlelight. And
will you relax with those lenses?
I'm obsessed with the lenses that the camera light. But you know, they had, you know, a table with just all pages of art books and the paintings that, you know, inspired his lighting. And then on this huge wall, you see the film clips and the juxtaposition of his lighting with the lenses that looks just like these, you know, Hogarth paintings. Great.
And it's an amazing, and also that, I mean, that's my favourite Kubrick film, Barry Lyndon. It's got that thing. It's really interesting. The annotations for that part of the show are really interesting because it's a a film that does the opposite of what most Hollywood films do, which is it deals in constant anti-climaxes. These old style sort of silent movie cards come up at the beginning of every section of that movie and tell you what's going to happen in it. You know, in which Barry finds, you know, that life isn't all it turned out to be and gets divorced from his wife or whatever. And these things pop up. So you know exactly what's going to happen. So you, the director and the actors are allowed to play with the conventions of the cinema.
Does the exhibition as a whole, and this is something else friends of mine who went to the Bowie exhibition said, the V&A, which on the one hand it's amazing and exciting and all the rest of it, but on the other hand, there's a kind of sadness about it because, one, you have living, breathing art, you know, encased in what is effectively a mausoleum, but it's also a reminder that this is a whole way of doing things, certainly in Bowie's case where music's concerned, is gone. It's very, very hard to imagine there will ever be another comparable figure for all sorts of reasons. Does the Kubrick exhibition kind of leave you mourning for the days of the sort of, you know, crazed auteur genius who doesn't really seem to exist in the same way anymore?
That's a really good question. For me, I think you're right. It's not something I've thought of. I kind of think it possibly does. I mean,
I disagree.
Really?
I came through so uplifted about, you know, the potential of cinema and that you can do cinema in an exhibition and you can do it in galleries. And it just makes you want to go back and see all the movies and find out more. I found it the exciting potential. And they are going to have a whole museum devoted to cinema sort of next door within a few years. And I just think it made you think, God, cinema can work within, you know, museum rooms.
There's another exhibition we should move on to. We should say that the Stanley Kubrick one is at the Art of the Americas building until June 30th for $20, free for members of the LACMA. Another exhibition that you want to talk about, this is at the Getty Center. It's Overdrive, LA Constructs the Future, it claims, 1940 to 1990. That rather suggests that they didn't actually succeed. LA constructs the future, 1940, gives up, 1990.
Yeah, they got to 1990 and went, Jesus, this is just one huge traffic jam.
Exactly.
That's the title, Overdrive.
Yeah, and it is. And this is a really, again, a really beautiful show at the Getty. And it is the celebration of the motor car. It's the celebration of a city made around the car. It's about drive-ins, or drive-throughs, should I say, with a U. It's about drive-throughs, and it's about the most sort of accessible and amazing modernity. And it's sort of, yeah, it's all about this city that was sort of embraced modernity, embraced the motor car, had space to sprawl in, like, you know, a low-rise, mad car-centered city, I suppose.
I mean, isn't it kind of a perverse thing to end up celebrating? Because as you intimated there, one of the signature experiences of Los Angeles is sitting in a car, stuck, going nowhere, wondering how long your beard is going to be by the time you get to where you're actually going.
Again, I'll disagree with you there. I just think, you know, LA has this reputation and everyone just talks about the car culture. But I mean, Rob and I, you know, discovered when we went into the hills. I mean, there's some of the most amazing examples of modernist architecture in residences. You just have to land at LAX airport and you see that incredible structure of the 60s where they had a real vision for an airport when a lot of people weren't thinking of grand plans of airports. And I think people think of it as a wasteland for design, but actually scratch the surface and you'll see there's, you know, some incredible modernist design there. It's not just about freeways.
Absolutely, no. I mean, the design's all there and it's kind of an amazing thing, but it is that interesting thing. It's maybe the only city in the world that was designed or redesigned around the sort of motor car, and whether that's successful or not, I don't think we ever got into a huge traffic jam over there. Actually, we should point that out. But it is it's a sort of nice form of architecture. That things are, I mean, and also the way that these buildings, these architectural renderings are done. And, you know, normally you populate an architectural rendering with, you know, or an artist's impression of a building with people kind of hanging out and walking in gardens and the rest of it. Whereas this was all about car parks. And it was kind of this amazing thing. It was kind of like a sexy Ballardian vision of the future. You know?
Sexy car parks.
Sexy car parks,
that's,
Andrew.
That's just totally what they should have called the exhibition. What does it actually contain, though? Is it just a celebration of Los Angelesian architecture? And how does it go about conveying that?
It's more than just the architecture. It starts with car design, doesn't it? It starts with car design.
Great newsreel footage, great commercials, great use of, I think the research they must have gone into to find all this old newsreel footage. And it's almost like a social history of the post-war years in that part of North America, because absolutely fantastic use of film footage.
Yeah, there's a kind of American dream thing to it. While New York was busy being itself as it can only be, LA at this time between 1940 and 1990, yeah. I guess, was sort of maybe slightly self-consciously, but forging ahead with like different design and the way that car design influenced buildings and influenced the way that you
drive-ins,
behave. It. Yeah, and it sort of it goes through that
movie culture.
Architecture, there's films, there's car design, and then there's the way, as you say, there's LA, there's a big section devoted to LAX, which to regard the beauty of it, you have to be circling it.
I speak as somebody who's generally been something of a Los Angeles skeptic. Do you think this exhibition might change my mind?
I think it would. I think you can do. There should be the equivalent of a sort of. I guess there are these architectural. The equivalent of star maps, you know. And you go, you can go up into the hills and see these amazing things, and look at the beauty of LAX through the heat haze over the bonnet of your car, Andrew. You can find beauty in everything.
On that delightful image, Rob Bound, thank you very much for joining us. If you are in Los Angeles anytime soon, Stanley Kubrick is on at LACMA until the 30th of June, and you can catch Overdrive, LA Constructs the Future 1940-90 at the Getty Museum until the 21st of July. And that brings us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Claire Urban.
We're handing back over to Emma Nelson with the weekend edition. Next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune in to the 200th edition of the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air Sunday with Rob Bound, Andrew Tuck and Tyler Brulé. It's a special anniversary edition of the show, so do tune in for that. But for now, you've been listening to The Review with me, Jillian Tobias.
And me, Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Berlin.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.